I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After a grueling week, the Missouri Legislature special session is over and done with. Today, we examine the so-called jobs bill that made it to Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' desk and what the process of passing it says about his relationship with the state legislature. Then, with one in five Americans suffering from a mental health condition, we ask, why is mental illness still so stigmatized? We'll take a very personal look at the issue and see how one man coped with his wife's psychosis and institutionalization. It affected their marriage in surprising ways. After that, this week's State House Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Missouri General Assembly's first special session under Governor Eric Greitens has come and gone, and more may be on the way. Lawmakers passed a so-called jobs bill, which would give special electric rate deals to an aluminum plant and steel mill that want to open in southeast Missouri. First this morning, a conversation about Missouri's new governor, who wants to do things differently, and what that might mean for Missouri. With us this morning, KCUR's Brian Ellison. Brian, welcome.
Good to be here.
He's host of KCUR's State House Blend Missouri podcast. Jason Rosenbaum also joins us. He covers the State House and politics for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, good morning to you.
Good to be on, Steve. Thank you for having me.
The governor, Brian, just got what he wanted. How big a victory was this for him?
Well, it is a victory. He got what he wanted in the sense that that first part of the bill you mentioned, the one that allows for lower electrical rates for these unnamed companies, one of which would come in and build a steel mill, another which would reopen the closed Naranda smelting plant, both down there in the Boot Heel. It is a win. On the other hand, there are others who won as well. Which might mean the governor didn't get a complete win. Senators Doug Leibla, Gary Romine, who opposed the second part of the bill, the part that would have created this this toolbox, this opportunity for Ameren to build other improvements to the electrical grid and the infrastructure in eastern Missouri, and consequently to raise rates to go along with that. That part of the bill was stripped out in a pretty much a bipartisan deal that happened before the House ended up voting on it. So yes, it was a win for Greitens, but it was not an unmitigated win.
Jason Rosenbaum, how did you see it?
Well, I saw it very similarly. And one of the things that kind of baffled me from a tactical standpoint is that both the governor and his aligned 501c4, A New Missouri, explicitly attacked people like Doug Leibla and Gary Romine for, quote, standing in the way of jobs, or standing in the way of the first proposal Brian was talking about. And then in the very beginning of the special session, legislators ended up taking out the thing that Leibla and Romine objected to. And I don't think it would be accurate for the governor or his supporters or his campaign staffers to say that the governor rolled over Leibla and Romine in this when they got exactly what they wanted, essentially. And I haven't really seen a lot of that happen, but I had kind of an inclination or assumption that that was going to be the messaging after this special session, that the governor's bully pulpit stood up to these big bad senators, when in reality, that's not really what happened.
You know, Steve, there's another way to think about whether the governor got a win. Did he get material out of what happened during that week in Jefferson City that will be of use to him in the future? One thing we all know happened was this series of rallies on the weekend before the legislators came back. There was a big rally at the Capitol where A New Missouri bussed in supporters from the Boot Heel, and they marched through the governor's office to leave notes on the doors of the senators who might otherwise have said they were going to be opposed. In other words, video cameras rolling the whole time, highly produced videos already out there on social media after those rallies. Did the governor get something else out of this special session besides a vote? He sure did.
You know, this is interesting to me, Jason. The governor says more special sessions may be on the way here. What do you make of that? I mean, this is a part-time legislature, and lawmakers have their own lives. They have jobs to attend to. And here he's saying there might be more of these things.
There is some irony in the fact that Governor Greitens made a pretty big deal about opposing a legislative pay raise during the year. One of the impacts of calling more special sessions is it is a de facto pay raise for lawmakers. When they come and vote, they get a per diem every day. So I haven't done the math, but it makes me wonder if they're going to make the amount of money that the governor was decrying on that end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum that I talked about when Greitens came into office is I think there is actually a danger in lawmakers doing too much in too short of a time. We saw in, you know, the mid-2000s, the Republican legislature and Republican Governor Matt Blunt pass a huge amount of things in his first year, and then they ran out of things to pass in his subsequent years and really became mired in some pretty bad infighting. Although, interestingly, as I'm sure we'll talk about, there's still quite a bit of infighting, even though they haven't accomplished everything.
Yeah.
They didn't wait till the second session for that.
Is there grumbling amongst lawmakers down there saying, you know, one special session is going to be enough? We're not going to come back again in June and July and August? Or what are you hearing, Jason?
I mean, it really depends on who you ask, because as you mentioned, a lot of these lawmakers do not kind of get into being senators or representatives with the idea that they're going to be there indefinitely. A lot of them have other jobs. They have family commitments. And I'm certain that Republicans and Democrats are probably a little annoyed that they would have to come back multiple times when that wasn't really their plans. On the other hand, I think that some legislators who are disappointed with the low amount of bills that were passed during the regular session are probably willing to do more if given the chance. I think it's really a case-by-case scenario.
And on top of that, Brian, the governor sort of shamed them to come back. I mean, you guys didn't get your jobs done. Come on back and do some more work.
Right. I'm cutting short your vacation. Right. And of course, you know, some of them tweeted afterward, these legislators saying, it wasn't vacation. It was taking care of my children.
Yeah.
It was getting back to the job that actually pays me enough to live on. There was a lot of taunting, really, about the fact that they are not really career politicians. But remember, isn't that ironic? His attack against the legislators is that they are career politicians. In fact, none of them are paid to be there year-round. He is. The governor is the only one of them that is.
So, Jason Rosenbaum, there's a lot of grandstanding going on here on the governor's part. Am I seeing that correctly?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a subjective term.
Yes.
But, which I'm not really sure I can answer fully. But I think, especially on the special session, I think it's a really hard argument to make that, you know, Senators Libel and Romine were standing in the way of something, of a steel mill or the Noranda smelter opening, when in actuality they were standing in the way of a proposal that could have made it easier to raise electrical rates in in their neck of the woods. And once that was taken out, I think it was pretty widely perceived that even though this may end up opening some pretty substantially important businesses in the boot heel, it's pretty hard to say that it was like a sweeping win for the governor. Right. It really does seem like people like Libel and Romine won despite the heated rhetoric.
You know, whether or not we call this grandstanding, I think we can determine here, Brian Ellison, that the level of aggressiveness that this governor is showing certainly exceeds anything I've seen in my too many years covering Missouri state government going back to the late 1980s. I mean, this is really an extraordinary thing we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you define grandstanding as putting on a bigger show than necessary, I mean, the ultimate vote on this was 120-17 in the House. It was 24-5 in the Senate.
So you could argue the governor was right. They didn't get their jobs done. This was one that was an easy bill to pass.
But then it went on to expend an extraordinary amount of effort and money to build up the visuals, to make the speeches, to lead the march through the halls of the Capitol on something that by that point pretty much appeared to already be headed for passage. So was it grandstanding? I, like Jason said, that's a subjective call, but there was a lot of visible energy expended for something that didn't seem to be so controversial when you got right down to it.
So this notion, Jason, there may be more special sessions in the weeks ahead. What can you tell us about that? I mean, these things can't go on forever, can they?
I mean, they could hypothetically. He could call a special session every week if he wanted to. Yeah. I think what I've been hearing is there are several possible issues that another special session could happen in. It could be a prescription drug monitoring database, right, which actually has a lot of bipartisan support, but also has a lot of very loud opposition among some of the more conservative members of the legislature.
Senator Claire McCaskill is demanding it, right, from Washington.
She has called for a special session for that, as well as some other Republicans as well. You could hypothetically see some special sessions related to curbing organized labor. They didn't end up getting every anti-labor thing through the legislature this session. And you may end up seeing something related to, abortion related, as in trying to counteract some of these legal opinions that have come out in the last few months that would appear to make abortion facilities better able to expand in the state. So any of those topics are, I think, strong possibilities.
Other topics that sometimes come up, Steve, are ethics reform. That was named as a major priority of the governor's at the start of the session. It didn't really get any of the things he was seeking there. The lobbyist gift ban, the revolving door regulations for lobbyists. On the other hand, unlike the special session that just ended, those would not be easy wins for him. The proposals that he offered were dead on arrival in the Senate and in some cases in the House as well. So he may not want to call a session where he's not going to have a quick and clear victory.
I was going to say, if he calls it on ethics, and we've written so much about that on the editorial board at the Star, reporters across the state have written so much about it. I mean, that would sort of resurrect, Brian, all the issues that are now clouding Governor Greitens' horizon when it comes to ethics. And you wonder if he would go there or not.
Well, and that's
what an interesting call that would be.
It would be very interesting. And you've probably identified there, Steve, exactly the reason that there won't be a special session on ethics. As high a priority as the governor said that is, a lot of people think that he's really undermined his ability to be an authority on that issue, to take the lead. It would bring up too many negative things. And if there's one thing we know about the governor, he does not want negative press out there in the ways that that might affect his future.
Jason, could you see a special session on ethics or not? Is that too much too soon?
Probably not, because as Brian alluded to, there is not really a lot of appetite to ban lobbyist gifts in the Senate. That was true before Greitens came into office. But to expand on that point, what Brian was talking about is that the governor has been, I'd say, riddled with criticism from both parties for relying on this 501c4, A New Missouri.
Right.
And I think the reason the criticism is there, and I think it might have gotten lost in a little bit, is that Greitens himself, when he was campaigning, was very, very critical of his opponents for setting up, quote, secretive super PACs that were attacking him. And then he basically, during the campaign and after he's elected, all of this secretive, undisclosed money has been helping him over the last year and a half. So a lot of mainly Democrats, but also some Republicans, see him as profoundly hypocritical on that issue. And just the idea, I think he was quoted on another radio station in St. Louis kind of defending the ability of 501c4 groups that are politically active to conceal their donors, when only a year and a half ago he was talking about how transparency was the greatest thing about a no-limit campaign system. And I mean, there's no other way to put it. He contradicted himself,
mm-hmm.
and the record is pretty clear. That's not subjective. That is factual. And I think that that's hurting him.
You know, what's interesting, though, again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the just concluded special session of the Missouri General Assembly. Jason Rosenbaum from St. Louis Public Radio is with us, as is KCUR's Brian Ellison. You know, what is interesting about all of this is the tremendous political position Governor Greitens finds himself in here. He really has the high ground here. He calls a special session, Brian Ellison, and they don't do what he wants. He can go around the state saying, your do-nothing legislature, didn't get the job done. If they do what he wants, he can claim tremendous victories here. This guy can't lose.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that perspective. You know, one of your colleagues on the Star editorial board, Dave Helling, and I were at an event where Dave made the point that Eric Greitens needs something to run on. He can't damage all of his relationships. I'm not sure I agree with Dave about that. I think Eric Greitens is preparing for whatever his future holds to be able to point to the opposition around him as the do nothing, fight everything, accomplish little opponents, and he wins no matter what by setting himself up as the person who takes initiative and tries to get things done.
You know, Jason, I'm wondering how functional the state Senate is these days. I mean, the upper chamber, it seems to me, is more broken than I've ever seen it. Don't like something, you know, you filibuster it and you shut the Senate down. Then the Republican majority can end that filibuster and move on with its business. But then there are so many bad feelings left in the wake of all that people can hardly speak to each other. What do you make of it these days?
I don't want to say it's unprecedented, because I think 10 years ago that the maneuver that you alluded to, which is called the previous question, a maneuver that kills filibusters, was used often, and it created bad feelings between the Democratic caucus and the Republican caucus. I will say, though, I was there the last week of session. I had never seen the Senate as chaotic as it was during that last day when senators tried to kill a filibuster on a minimum wage related bill. And I mean, from kind of a tactical perspective, I kind of thought that some of the people who were around in 2007 were a lot more ruthless and efficient in doing that, whereas the people who are there now just weren't. But on the other hand, it kind of just showed how bad the relationships are in the Senate. I think part of that could be one of the unintended consequences of term limits, when you have people that can filibuster and try to kill things with really no ability to get thrown out of office. You may see that more. But I also just think that when you have a situation now where things that get passed from the Senate often is the last, the Senate is the last backstop before things go to Greitens, emotions tend to run higher under that setup.
I was going to say, Brian Ellison, that the Senate is supposed to be the place where the adults reside, and this is supposed to be a more sober, somber chamber, careful deliberation. But man, they sure tested that proposition this year.
That is for sure. And at its best, Steve, it is that. I mean, you could still listen in on the average day and hear the senators inquire of one another across party lines. They don't sit by party in the Senate. They're all mixed up. It can be a very deliberative body. But you are correct. In fact, a number of senators that we've had on State House Blend Missouri have talked about the houseification of the Senate.
Yes.
There was a time where
houseification is a new word for it.
Every senator was an island before, and now they are much more. There are attempts, at least by their party leadership, to whip them into line. Notably, the Republicans in the Senate have rebelled against that kind of treatment, and that's been the source of a lot of the conflict. I mean, it's worth pointing out, Steve, that this isn't mostly Republicans versus Democrats causing the conflict in the Senate. This is Republicans versus Republicans, who occupy a more than two-thirds majority in that body, wrestling among themselves for who will win out.
You know, Jason, you mentioned earlier that when Governor Matt Blunt came into office, Republicans controlled everything. They passed a whole bunch of stuff and then didn't have much to do for a couple of years. What's left on the GOP agenda for next year and then down the road?
Actually, quite a bit. Because the legislature only passed, I think it was maybe 70 bills, if you include the budget. I'm kind of roughly estimating there. They didn't end up passing what I would consider, you know, education savings accounts, which basically provide some public funding of some. Well, let me back up there. They didn't really pass a lot of the education reform related things that they wanted to pass. They didn't pass everything they wanted to do to organize labor. And they didn't pass a lot of tax related things either. So I actually think that there's a lot of things for them to do. But if they get kind of continue mired in this infighting that we're talking about, especially in the Senate, the ability to accomplish these things will get harder and harder with each subsequent year.
Just a few seconds left, Brian. Then there is the Missouri Department of Transportation, highways. That's a big issue that still sits out there unaddressed.
Big issue, fairly bipartisan, but never finds a solution. Transportation was barely discussed in this session, and here's Missouri with proportionally more highway miles per the size of the population than almost any other state. Still no answer on how to build additional revenue to make the necessary repairs.
Well, gentlemen, great conversation about the Missouri General Assembly. I want to thank KCUR's Brian Ellison. Brian, always appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Jason Rosenbaum covers the State House and politics for St. Louis Public Radio. Jason, you were great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Time for a break. We're going to change topics dramatically and talk about the man whose wife suffered a psychotic break and how that affected their marriage. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday, our film critics gave us their picks and pans of the latest indie, foreign, and documentary films showing in area theaters. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. On tomorrow's program, the children's doctors are in to discuss developmental milestones and red flags to watch for in a child's early years. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, marriage has enough stresses, so it's not hard to imagine what the addition of a psychotic break can do. Mark Lukacs' wife suffered just such a break 3 years into their marriage. It was followed by two more. Julia was diagnosed with major depression, with psychosis, and eventually bipolar disorder. Together, the couple has been navigating a new world, and you can only imagine the pressures all this has placed on their marriage, as each partner suddenly has developed new roles. Mark as caregiver, Julia as patient. Mark Lukacs has written a new memoir of the couple's challenging times. It's titled My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. And Mark, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Morning. Nice to have you as well. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You betcha. And you and Julia had been married for 3 years when things started to change. What were the early signs that something significant was amiss here, Mark?
You know, it's hard to say early signs because it actually happened incredibly rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
But Julia started a new job. She's always been really accomplished and career-driven. And she was making a move into a new career. And it was actually even that first day, I noticed that the confidence that she usually imbues around her work, there was just a hesitation there.
Mm.
I wasn't exactly sure why, but that within a couple days, she was calling me while she was at work asking for help. Like, I got to email my boss. Can you proofread this email? And she'd send it over. And it was only a couple line long, couple lines and really basic, but mm-hmm. she was still so stuck on it. And it was just like, so it was just sort of like anxiety, you know, and that anxiety became really big, really quickly, where she lost her appetite. She'd just pick at the dinner each night. She started to have trouble falling asleep. We'd spend hours trying to like do meditations and massage and all this other stuff to try to get her to calm down and go to sleep. And then eventually she just stopped sleeping altogether. It was when she stopped sleeping that things kind of progressed into the next realm of what I now know is psychosis. At the time, I had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
But she was paranoid. She was delusional, complete inability to sleep, and then also acting pretty suicidal as well. So that's where I took her to the emergency room.
I was going to say, tell us what happened on the morning of September 7th, 2009. That's a marker day in your life here.
It is. You know, she woke up and I woke up, I should say. You know, each night I would try to stay awake with Julia to comfort her, but you just fall asleep, right?
Sure,
you can't
sure.
help it. And so I woke up and Julia's standing in the room, pacing around, really agitated, saying, the devil was here and I need to protect everybody from the devil and there's no point and I'm never going to get better. It's all over. You should just leave me and never deal with me again, basically. And so her parents were in town. Her dad had to physically pick her up to get her into the car. She was refusing to come with us.
Right.
And we had to drive across the city to the emergency room where along the way, she actually tried to open the door to leave the moving car. I mean, it was horrifying. You know, it was truly the stuff of nightmares. When my father-in-law and I were carrying her, we had this moment where we looked at each other. And I certainly didn't recognize that I had been crying, but it was seeing him cry that we had this moment of realization of like just what we were doing and how horrifying this was.
Man. You said that when you got to the hospital, Mark, your hope was along the lines of you hope that maybe a doctor would step forward and hand your wife a pill and an hour later things would be back to normal. But that isn't how it works, right?
Yeah, both of us were really naive to what mental illness looks like and what the treatment of it is. And of course, I knew there's medication for this stuff, but I didn't realize that it can take weeks to have an impact. That in many ways, because of the complexity of the brain, it's kind of a guessing game. You're dealing with a symptom. So you try one medicine and see if it deals with the symptom. And if not, you replace it with another. But yeah, I fully expected we were going to show up there. And the doctor was going to say, okay, this is exactly what she has. Here's the right pills. She'll sleep it off and everything's going to be fine tomorrow. I mean, it was ridiculously naive, but I think it also kind of gives a sense of how I don't think my understanding of mental illness was that off the cultural norm. I think it's such an understood field of medicine. You know, people just don't know what it all entails.
Is there a history of mental illness in her family?
No, you know, that's what a lot of the doctors were asking because it tends to be genetic. Her parents were there. We were talking about it. Now, granted, Julia's from Italy, where the cultural way of dealing with mental health is a little different than in the United States. But even that being said, they were like, they didn't know of anyone in the family history who would have had such a severe mental illness that would have led to like a full-blown psychotic episode, you know?
Now, I'm wondering what it was like for you, Mark, to have this happen, not just to any loved one, but this is your wife we're talking about here.
Yeah, you know, I think I can just hear from your voice that you kind of get it, because when crisis happens, you turn to your most trusted confidant for emotional support, for advice. You know, I had to make some really hard decisions. I was obviously grieving and feeling really terrified. And that person who I would default turn to was the person who I couldn't turn to. Mm-hmm. And I think even since it was a mental illness as compared to a physical illness, like, for example, a cancer diagnosis, her emotional state was so fragile that it really, truly made it. I could not show her any signs of how difficult this was for me because I was afraid that they might amplify her and make her more worried or more suicidal. And so I really just had to put on this steeled face of like being a cheerleader. You know, you just go in, visit her, pretend everything's great, pretend you're not like devastated by what's going on, and then come home. And in like the solitude and the loneliness of being home alone, that's when you sort of let it all out of just how difficult it is.
She was eventually diagnosed with what? What are we talking about here?
Well, after the first episode, they thought it was major depression with psychotic features, which is sort of like, I kind of interpreted that as a way of calling it a nervous breakdown. But she did have subsequent episodes, a second and then a third. And it was in the second episode that they updated her diagnosis to bipolar disorder. And you know, if I can just add to that real quick.
Yeah.
At first, again, in sort of my initial understanding and expectation of medicine, I put a lot of importance on knowing what the diagnosis was because I thought you had to name it in order to be able to treat it. Mm-hmm. But I would say today I've put so much less importance because I really have grown to understand that mental health is about symptoms and trying to deal with symptoms as compared to what all a fixing label, because these labels, there's these textbook experiences of these diagnoses, but Julia was so out of the realm of the ordinary that it's bipolar, but it's really Julia's experience of what she goes through, you know, and we just try to treat it for what it is.
Mark Lukacs is my guest. He's the author of a new book, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. Even when she came out of the psych ward, Mark, after 23 days, that's a long time, but she wasn't the same. Tell us how she was at that point.
No, well, first off, you're right. That is a long time. Most patients are in there around 3 to 4 days, and Julia was there for 23.
Right.
When she came home, she was heavily medicated to try to suppress the psychosis, but that medication kind of suppressed everything for her, where she was really low affect, very little emotional response, kind of slow to respond, both physically but also kind of in how she was processing. So the pace of the day was incredibly slow for us. But I would say beyond just the medication impact, she was also deeply, deeply depressed and suicidal because she found the experience of the hospital to be so traumatizing, to go and not be able to trust her own mind, to believe that the people around her, including her family, were out to get her. What she would say to me is, I'm never going to be able to come back from that. And so it was this just like, it felt almost like unending sense of doom and dread. And that lasted a really long time too. When she came out of the hospital, she went to an outpatient program, and the case manager told us that most patients are in the outpatient program for 3 to 4 weeks, and Julia was in it for a solid 9 months.
Now, she would ask you these questions, and I wondered how you dealt with them. These questions of, you know, if a person commits suicide, do they still get a funeral? What would you say to that?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
The panic inside of you must have been extraordinary, at least initially, and probably to some extent the whole time.
Yeah, I don't know what you say to that. I think what you have to do, you know, it's this really interesting push and pull of like, do you just ignore it because you don't want to go into that and you don't think, my wife's going to kill herself? Do I have to like fully address it and really try to rationalize with her around funeral arrangements, whether it's a suicide or not? You know, it's just, so I struggle with that a lot. My default, I think, was to hear what she would say, you know, try to empathize. Oh, I'm so sorry that you're so concerned about these really difficult thoughts. But then try to kind of bring her back into where I was emotionally in the realm I was in. Hey, but let's not forget, we're out on the beach right now with our dog. It's a beautiful afternoon. Let's try to be here together now and not get lost in these hypotheticals, at least what I would call hypotheticals. You know?
I was going to say the marriage, obviously, there's some strain here. And to top it off, all of the stuff you're dealing with, Mark, she was particularly upset with the way you had managed her illness. Why?
Well, as I was doing all this, as I would, you know, wake up and basically present to her a plan for the day that would have us out of the house and being active, Julia, as I learned after the fact, felt kind of managed and even a little bit suffocated by the way that I was trying to treat things. I kind of had this thought that you can only think about one thing at a time. And so if I could keep Julia doing things that consumed her thinking, that would kind of monopolize her ability to be focused on suicide. But for her, again, she felt like she didn't really get a say in what we were doing. Now, my rebuttal was, you know, Julia, if I asked you what you want to do, you'd tell me you'd want to drive to the Golden Gate Bridge and jump off. So I'm not going to let you do that. So yeah, we're going to go to yoga instead, you know? But I couldn't, I sort of justified and sort of talked over this sense of feeling a loss of autonomy. But what we realized in the wake of it all was, no, there was actually some really deep-seated resentment about how dismissive I was around her goals and how she wanted to approach things, because I sort of had this, well, I'm not sick and I'm not suicidal, so I'm going to make these decisions on your behalf, you know?
Yeah. You go through all this, then the two of you took an around-the-world trip together. At the end of that journey, she wrote an open letter to you on the blog that I guess you two shared. And that was something that she wrote, something that you were had been just dying to hear, Mark. What was it?
Yeah, basically after 10 months, 1 month in the hospital, 9 months in outpatient program, of trying my best to love and support her through an incredibly terrifying and trying year, I needed Julia to just recognize that I had done my best and I had loved her to my fullest and that it was hard for me and she loved me for it, you know? And that sounds, I think, a little emotionally needy, but I also think that we all need validation, right?
Sure.
We work hard. We need someone to just say, hey, I see what you're doing and thank you for it. And so it literally was on the last day of this trip that we took together to try to heal together that Julia wrote me this email or this letter that really felt like it did just that, where she said, I see you, and I see your struggle and your pain and your effort, and I appreciate it. And that was so transformative to me.
You know, it's interesting how you mark progress in something like this. She had other episodes, and then a routine sort of got established between the two of you for how you would handle these things. And then she once said this, I never want this to happen again, but if it does, I'm more optimistic that it's going to be more manageable. And that's a good thing, right?
It is, you know, but that took a lot of time and work to get there, because if I had to characterize the three episodes that Julia's had, which, like you said, they all follow the same pattern. They hit really hard and really fast and go immediately psychosis. After the psychosis, it becomes this deep suicidal depression. And then that eventually resolves and she's kind of back to normal. The first one, we were basically like, you know, existential angst around what is happening to us. The second one was the wake-up call that we weren't going to get away with this with only one. This was going to be a recurring part of our life. And therefore, we had to be proactive around what this illness looks like and how it was changing and shaping our lives. And yeah. Then there was the third one where we actually had done the hard work of making some decisions and putting some plans in place where if Julia was hospitalized, this is how we would want to approach it differently. And we basically got to put him into experimentation with that third episode. And interestingly enough, it was her shortest hospitalization. Yeah. It was her shortest depression. It was the only episode where she didn't have to leave her job. I mean, it was by far what I would say the most successful, you know, kind of in air quotes, but successful way that we had to handle this sort of crisis.
You know, Mark, this is cruel. I just got 20 seconds left here, and this is such an important and fascinating story. How is she today?
I appreciate you asking. She's great. It's been 2.5 years since she's been hospitalized. She, I think, is really empowered by having this book out here. She's doing wonderful. It's awesome.
Is she okay with the book? Because this is pretty personal stuff.
It is, you know, and it took us a lot of discussion to get to the point of wanting to go public with this, but I think we both believe that the book has the potential to help people, and that is a really wonderful thing to do. And so we're believers in it, and we're out there doing it.
It's a great contribution. Mark Lukacs' new book, My Lovely Wife in the Psych Ward. Mark, thanks so much. All the best to you and your wife. I sure appreciate the time.
Thanks. I appreciate it as well.
Now it's time for State House Blend, Missouri. This week's podcast was recorded live at Kansas City's Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, where hosts Brian Ellison and Representatives Brandon Ellington, Daron McGee, and Gail McCann Beatty had a conversation about an important question of the session: are Kansas City's communities of color being heard in Missouri's capital?
Unfortunately, I would have to say we're not. We've got some really passionate reps that represent urban communities both in Kansas City and St. Louis. And the interesting thing is they speak on the floor and you can hear a pin drop. You know everyone's listening. But at the end of the day, it doesn't change how they vote.
Representative McGee?
So to your question, I think it's two things. I think it's less about color. I think it's more about folks who are dealing and struggling with poverty and class. I think there's been a major assault on folks who are poor in this state. I serve on the budget committee, and one of the things that we saw, particularly in budget, when we have a $500 million deficit, was that cuts were going to seniors, to higher education, to folks who really needed extra help, who could not afford without some of the tax incentives and some of the extra programs, social programs that we need to make ends meet. And that has nothing to do with color. That is about your economic status in life. And I think that was the bigger assault than anything.
Would it be right to say, though, that communities of color might be more significantly
affected? I think that's a fair assessment.
So the population of Missouri is about 18% non-white, and the last session that I could find stats for
on the racial composition of the General Assembly was the last session, so 2015, but 13% of the General Assembly was non-white in the year 2015. That's less than the population as a whole, but it's not hugely less. Why then are the communities of color not being heard? They're present. What's the problem?
Part of it is there is an agenda that has been put out there that tends to hurt our communities much more. As Representative McGee said, there is a effort to basically hurt those that are in need. There is this idea that everyone should be able to pull themselves up out of poverty. Now, if you want to take people off of assistance, then let's give them enough money so that they can survive. That's the way to get them off of assistance. But to say, I did a Facebook Live with Senator Sylvie a couple weeks ago, and he said, well, I really like the way our minimum wage is tied to an index. And I thought to myself, our last increase was a nickel. A nickel. That's $2 a week, $8 a month. How fast does the price of gas go up, or a gallon of milk, or a loaf of bread? And that's $8 gross. That's before taxes. At the end of the day, it's probably $5 or $6. So if you really want to do something to help people, to get people off of a system, then allow them to earn money.
Representative McGee, let me ask you a question. It's a comment that someone made on our event page on Facebook for this event. It's a woman named Nakenya. She couldn't be here tonight, but here's what she said. She said, this question of whether communities of color are heard in Jeff City, applies to this country as a whole. Are they being heard in America? The question is no, she said. I've been in Kansas City going on 6 years, and yes, to those who believe we've had an African-American president and an African-American mayor, the African-American community has not benefited from this. It's being left behind in all of Kansas City's, quote, newfound fame. The East Side has to wait on the development success in the downtown area to trickle down before they're given funding. It's one thing to provide a budget, but what's the money actually going towards and into whom's pocket? What do you think when you hear that, Ron McGee?
I think there's an inherent distrust in the community with elected officials in general, because election after election, people have promised and just never delivered. And in the process of the promises, not much has changed. You have not seen a lot of economic activity. And if there is, the community surrounding the area where the economic activity has happened, they feel left out of the process or the activity itself. But I think that the Black Caucus was united on one issue this session, both Democrat and Republican, and that was opposing Senate Bill 43, which makes it easier to discriminate against folks who both are minorities, women, in both employment and in housing. And that's particularly concerning because when you talk about raising the burden of proof for victims and who are victims of discrimination, that's a huge issue that affects not only minorities, but it affects women and it affects folks of color. And I think that was one issue that we came together on and opposing. So.
And of course, this bill would say that you have to be able to prove that discrimination was the motivating factor,
correct,
not just a contributing factor,
correct,
to prove a discrimination case.
Correct.
There's a lot of movement to ask the governor to veto Senate Bill 43. People are quoting things he said during the campaign about discrimination being unacceptable. Do you guys think he will veto it?
I don't, only because the governor had, if you remember in the last election, the governor had one endorsement in the last election that really mattered, and that was the Missouri Chamber of Commerce. Everybody else was with Chris Koster, the NRA, the Farm Bureau, everybody who traditionally Republican supporters were with Chris Koster, the Democrat. The Missouri Chamber has been trying to get this done for like 10 years, and this was like one action item that they wanted. I find it highly unlikely that the governor does not sign this.
Just like Representative McGee, I don't think he's going to veto it, but I want to touch on it just to go back to the same sentiment of what's actually happening in the state of Missouri. So you have an enclave of folks that's taking care of their own, right? So when we talk about the business community, it doesn't benefit anybody in here that works. It doesn't benefit any women. It doesn't benefit anybody that identifies sexually in any type of way. It doesn't benefit any so-called minority. But what it does benefit is that same enclave. So in the piece of legislation, the senator actually filed this bill for the last two sessions. He's been filing bills to take away the ability for people to prove discrimination because he's been sued consistently for discrimination. The lawsuit that he has this year has a dossier of all type of cuss words in there in racial epithets and racial slurs, and we chose to pass this because of the same enclave.
And I also like to add, too, I was at a luncheon recently, and then this is really, this would be troubling to everyone listening to this. Whether you are black, white, male, female, transgender, no matter who you are, people should be very concerned because the fact that you have companies, we are in this position because the Republican majority has given large tax breaks to companies that frankly didn't need it. And I was sitting at a luncheon recently, and folks said this was a very good year for the legislative session for business. It was not about people. It was about business. And that's what this whole legislative session was about business, business, business. And people should be concerned about
that. And would you be okay with that if the projections of increased economic growth came true and the budget were arranged in a way that that did, in fact, help with communities that are impoverished?
Right. And it's not. I think it was Representative Ellington who said it's about an agenda and not about the people. If you go to Missouri Chamber's website, you will see that the majority of the legislation, all the tort reform, is all about Missouri Chamber's agenda. But what this is doing to our budget, you know, when we have a $500 million shortfall this year, and we have no idea what that's going to look like for next year, so now what do we cut? So we will again attack senior services. We will attack services to the disabled. We will attack Medicaid. All of these things, these are the first things that we decide, oh, well, we don't need anymore. And, you know, I was speaking to someone earlier today and I said, it's interesting that we've done all of these, this legislation in the name of making Missouri more business friendly. And I asked the question, so where are the businesses? When are they coming? Because I don't see the businesses coming. And we spent this week having to give businesses more incentives to get them here. When is enough enough? And how long are we going to make our citizens suffer in the name of being more business friendly?
I want to say thank you to all three of our guests, Representative Gail McCann-Beatty, Representative Brandon Ellington, and Representative Deron McGee. Let's say thank you to all of our guests here tonight. State House Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Special thanks tonight to Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church and Pastor Wallace Hartsfield II. Thank you very much. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for listening.
That was a live taping of KCUR State House Blend Missouri podcast. To hear the full conversation, subscribe to the show wherever you get our podcasts or on the NPR One app. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, the milestones in a child's early years and the developmental red flags to look out for. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.